Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
I think this is more like a forest fire. I don't think that this is going to slow down. I'm not sure that the influenza analogy applies anymore. I think that wherever there is wood to burn, this fire is going to burn. And right now, we have a lot of susceptible people. And so I think right now, I don't see this slowing down through the summer or into the fall. I don't think we're going to see one, two, and three waves. I think we're going to just see one very, very difficult forest fire of cases.
Paul Douglas and Jordana Green. That was Dr. Michael Osterholm. He was on Meet the Press yesterday, and that quote rocked me when I heard that.
Yep.
And part of me wants to say, well, maybe he's exaggerating, but you know what? He's been pretty much dead on to date. And again, when we start to ignore the scientists, bad things happen. It's kind of a Dickens thing, best of times, worst of times. You know, the cases are coming down in Minnesota, Jor. Some encouraging news close to home. But across the South, half the U.S. states reporting a rise in new cases.
Right.
And some of these states are breaking daily records. And in the South, more young people are testing positive. Florida saw 4,000 new cases on Saturday. So much for the heat squashing the bug. The governor of Florida, Governor DeSantis, said the average age is now 37 years old for new cases. Back in March, the average age was 65. Some of that is more testing, but health officials say the rise has more to do with people not wearing masks, large gatherings, you know, maybe turning up the dial too fast. U.S. authorities, Jor, report 30,000 new infections a day over the last few days. And again, we're up to 120,000 fatalities in the United States. Worldwide, 468,000 people have died. 9 million people have been infected. The World Health Organization says the pandemic is still accelerating. And something that took my breath away, it took 3 months for the world to see the first million virus infections. The last million cases have taken place in just 8 days. One of the theories why the rates are going up in Arizona, Florida, southern states, is because it's too hot to be outside. People go inside. They want their air conditioning. And when you're indoors, especially if you don't have a mask on, and you're staying in one place for an extended period of time, the odds of infection go up. So, again, it's too early to let our guard down, too early to let our masks down. We need to be cautious.
Interesting, though, how you mentioned that, you know, in Minnesota, we have not seen the surge go up yet. They say, you know, it just in the Star Tribune today, there's not a surge, especially because we've had, you know, these protests. We've had people gathering in the streets together. We've had people in close contact. You know, every time I've been down to the memorial, I'm in close contact with people, even though I wear a mask. And we saw a lot of the protesters wearing a mask. So in Minnesota, we haven't seen that yet, and that is a good thing. You probably hear the chainsaw in my
yard. Is that what that is?
Yeah. Yeah, so there's that.
Okay.
So if you boys, we haven't been together since Wednesday because I was off on Thursday for Marley's surgery, and then you guys were off on Friday. Thursday night, we had that big storm. Thanks, Paul. Half of my lawn was covered by half of my tree. We have a big, beautiful tree. I don't know what it is because I don't know anything. big, beautiful tree. I don't know if it was lightning or winds. The tree had a bit of a disease, some mold in there. Cracked the thing in half, and it's on my lawn. Please check out my Insta page. I took a video. We did a couple segments on this on Friday. I'm at Jordana Verde, V-E-R-D-E, on Instagram. And there I showed a video of the tree, and I asked people what we can do. And people said, no, you can save it. And then they looked at the video, and they said, no, you really can't save it. And I'm devastated because I love this tree. We have two trees in my yard, and this one has red leaves, and my house is plain. It's like black and white, and this tree is red, and it's so beautiful. And handsome husband, he is efficient. So he called the tree guys, got a bunch of estimates, and they are coming and taking down my gorgeous, beautiful tree right now. That's what you're
sure,
hearing.
There's
Don't worry, I have a time-lapse video running, so you'll be able to see it.
I'm sorry for your loss. I really am, and I had nothing to so do sad. With that, by the way. Might have
been you kill trees. You actually are the tree murderer.
Well, you accused me of being a tree murderer a couple of years ago
that.
When we had to bring our trees down. But we planted new trees, and they're doing well, and that's the beauty. You can plant more, right? Is that what you're going to do?
Thank God. We will. This is an expensive endeavor.
Yeah.
So, again, the kids will not be able to go to college anytime soon.
But you'll have
because,
trees.
Boy, they charge a lot of money for the chopping of the trees. Regardless, we will probably – I'd like to plant another one. I really would. But I don't want, like, one of those little puny ones that – I don't – I'd like a big tree. But, again, Mama's going to need like, a home equity line or a second – or a third job at this point, you know, to be able to afford all of this. So I apologize, but intermittently, you know, still working from home because of the COVID, and you will hear the giant chainsaw for about the next 2 hours.
It's very authentic. I wondered what Welcome that was. Home. I thought that was your stomach. I didn't know.
Yeah, generally I won't go and have a discussion about adult toys, but these adult toys are outside in very strong manner, using them in a very safe way. They're wearing eye protection and ear protection and hard hats and all that stuff, and the tree is coming down. I'll try and go shoot some shots during the break. Sad.
So cool. Sad.
Yeah,
sorry,
not really.
You're...
Not really. Yeah. When we get back, Dr. Yohuru Williams, the dean and distinguished chair of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of St. Thomas, will join us to talk about something called the Racial Justice Initiative. That's next on CCO. It's 3:19. Jordana and Paul, thank you for joining us on a fabulous Monday. I hope you are feeling well and healthy, confident, happy. I hope you are feeling all of those things. A new Monday, a new week. Dr. Yohuru Williams is the Dean and McQuinn Distinguished Chair of the College of Arts and Sciences, at the University of St. Thomas. He's joining us now on the CenterPoint Energy Home Service Plus hotline to talk about a new effort at the university called the Racial Justice Initiative. Dr. Williams, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
So tell us, define it for us. What is the Racial Justice Initiative?
It's really our effort at the University of St. Thomas to take a hard look at the ways that we can be part of continuing conversations in the Twin Cities about racial justice and equity. And really what I'm hoping to do, is rather than try to start something that's new, figure out ways that we can work collaboratively and strategically with community partners to connect the work that we're doing and to make a real impact on issues of justice and equity in the Twin Cities. And part of that work is the process of historical recovery, and we saw this on full display last week. So we had a week where everyone was talking about, obviously, the tragedy and the tragic murder of George Floyd, but then that was coming as we were commemorating the 100th anniversary of the Duluth lynching and the posthumous pardon of Max Mason. We were talking about the president going to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and the historical lack of historical consciousness about the Black Tulsa race riot of 1921. And we were celebrating Juneteenth. So not knowing that history and not being able to make those connections across time sometimes puts us at a disadvantage for understanding what those problems historically have been, how we've sought to address them, where we've fallen short, and then what we can do picking up from there to move conversations forward.
Dr. Williams, I noticed that the president of St. Thomas talked about reimagining a model for how communities address race and do social justice work together. How can universities like St. Thomas and others help to change hearts and minds, in many cases, hearts and minds that don't want to be changed? How does that happen?
It's a great question, but I think the process of reimagination doesn't focus solely on what we do in terms of this generation. It's really about what we do with the next generation. So how do we partner with K-12 education to help young people develop a sense of investment and to become anti-racist the way that they think about each other and their communities? I'll give you a good example. I love the fact that in St. Paul, you have Melvin Carter proposed two initiatives, one the child savings account, the other was abolishing the fees for library cards. Now, anyone would look at that on the surface and say, well, I don't understand how the two are congruent, but they are. They're both about investment in some way in education as the blueprint forward for young people to, A, have an opportunity to learn about history, culture, and then apply that in a way that allows them to be civically engaged, and, B, to have a deep investment in the community and to see the community as invested in them. Universities have a role to play in that process by helping K-12 educators reimagine wraparound services that don't only look at what happens in the classroom, but consider housing disparities, consider health disparities, reimagine the way that we do work preparation and work programs. There were conversations when I left Connecticut several years ago about universal pre-K as one of the precursors to the type of deep investment we need in communities to help, again, reimagine the way that we engage with one another and then reimagine the way that we raise young people to be anti-racist, to be externally focused in terms of civic engagement, and to be thinking about themselves as not just people who live in a community, but people who are invested in that community and who believe that community is invested in them.
Okay. Are you also working with curriculums? I know you're talking about early, you know, early education, you know, K through 12. My mother was a teacher in inner city in New York and New Jersey for 25 years. And she was listening to my show from New Jersey the other day. And she goes, Jor, I'm so embarrassed. She's long retired now, of course. She says, I'm so embarrassed that I never heard of Juneteenth. I never heard. And, you know, she's a white woman, but all of her students were students of color. And she said, I'm embarrassed that I didn't know about it. And I said this on the air. You know, I didn't learn about this in school. I had a friend who's a history minor. She didn't learn a history minor in college, didn't learn about this in curriculum. Are you participating in those conversations about the way history has been rewritten and starting to teach the way the victors did not write it?
It's such a great question, Jordana, and absolutely. I think that's, in some sense, the linchpin of the work is the process of historical recovery. Let me give you a really concrete example. You said your mom taught in New Jersey. When I was in New Jersey about a decade ago, I worked on the New Jersey Amistad curriculum, and that was a mandate by the state of New Jersey to teach African-American history. Because of New Jersey, they recognized that this was a huge deficit, that young people didn't know that history, and so therefore so much misinformation about the history of the nation was filtered through a Eurocentric model of the way that we talk about who the victors are and what their contributions are. This goes beyond what we're seeing in some places now, like, for example, they're talking about, the national conversation around the removal of Confederate statues and even statues to Jefferson and, in some cases, you know, Lincoln and Theodore Roosevelt. That's only one piece. What do you replace that with? It has to be a comprehensive history of the United States that incorporates, you know, the good things that we've done in terms of our value system and our principles and in the warts that help us recognize those inflection points where we can do better. Understanding something about the history and culture of African Americans in the Twin Cities will help illuminate not only the accomplishments of people of color in these communities, but also the obstacles and impediments to full equality, which have defined that experience. And that's really what we need to tackle in this moment. So historical recovery is going to be a big part of that. And in the Twin Cities, we talk about this as a racial justice initiative, and we will be talking a lot about African Americans, but that's also got to include Hmong, Somali, Latino. It has to be indigenous peoples, broad enough and comprehensive enough that we are documenting and talking about the experiences of all the people who've contributed to the communities in which we live.
Dr. Williams, what would you say to listeners whose skin is white right now? They want to be part of the solution. They want to be on the right side of this issue, the right side of history. What would you say to them other than listening? I think it may be difficult for us to truly understand the anguish, the heartache, the trauma that people of color are experiencing and have been experiencing for centuries now, everything coming to a head. Is this different this time around? And what can white Americans do to lift up their black brothers and sisters?
It's a great question, Paul. I think there are three things. First and foremost, we can't run from this moment. I mean, we've been here before. If you look at the history of the United States, I can point to inflection points very similar to this contemporary moment where there seems to be a lot of attention on tackling the issue of race and racial inequalities. One of those moments saw the formation of the NAACP by white and black activists in the aftermath of the Springfield race riot in 1908. One of those inflection points was the March on Washington in 1963, which led to the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and ultimately the Voting Rights Act of 1965. But what happened in the aftermath of each of those events is that once people got that piece of legislation, or they felt that, you know, that milestone event had been accomplished, they deinvested and kind of moved on. We can't do that in this moment. We have to think long term about what it means to be engaged in a dialogue about how to really make the values of our republic real. And part of that work means, and this is too, really developing a mindset where we're anti-racist and we understand that requires action. So when people ask, well, you know, white people are really concerned about this, what can they do? I think part of it is to go through the process of educating oneself and then being uncomfortable, or being comfortable being uncomfortable in those difficult conversations that we as communities need to have about race in America. And then once we have those conversations, then comes the real hard part, which is action. What are the concrete things that we can do that are actually going to move us forward? And by concrete, I don't mean a one-time donation to an organization or an investment in a scholarship or something like that. I mean participation in ongoing conversations and ongoing movements to reform things like our criminal justice system, to address housing inequality, to talk about food health disparities and food deserts. I mean, ultimately, those things make us all safer. And they create what Dr. King called the beloved community. And don't we all want to belong to that beloved community? That's something that places an emphasis on our shared humanity, the ways in which we can come together as a community and recognize that we all do better when we eliminate those things that obstruct our ability to live our best lives. Mm-hmm. And as a community, when you ask specifically about what white people can do, I think it's those three things. Be willing to have that dialogue, be comfortable being uncomfortable, and then be ready to act. Take that step from, you know, this is really terrible watching this video and feeling overcome by the moment to, hey, these are the incremental steps that I'm going to make, the things that I plan to do every day that are going to put me at the forefront of helping to shift conversation and move us forward as a community, as a state, and as a nation.
Dr. Williams, we all wish you the very best of luck with the Racial Justice Initiative at the University of St. Thomas. Thank you so much for joining us today, sir.
Please come
back.
Thank
you for having me. I appreciate
yes,
that.
Please.
Thank you.
Yes. These are conversations we need to be joining in. We need to be having more. We need to be asking him what he's hearing, what we need to know. Paul, wow. He said, this is one thing I've been grappling with, and I know we're late for the break, David, but why is this different and how is this different? You know, we had Martin mm-hmm. Luther King Jr. We have been in this place before where we know we're doing this wrong and we live in a racist society and it needs to change. And what he said was, once the certain legislation got passed, whether it was segregation or voting rights or whatever it was, you know, things seemed to calm down a little bit. And we shouldn't let that happen here. So once police reform gets passed, because this seems to be a movement about police reform, we can't let up. We have to take it to the next level. And that was an aha moment there in that conversation from him. Really, really good stuff. Okay,
it's
I'm sorry.
It's not a flash in the pan. You're right.
Yes. When we return, a meditation on empathy, and the owners of Du Nord Craft Spirits have suffered during this pandemic, during these recent protests. We will talk to the owners next. Oh, it's time to relax for one moment, folks. I want you to know that meditation can make you more compassionate. There are studies that show meditation can be a kindness cure. And if you meditate, it means you become more empathetic and you become kinder. Now, I know you're saying, oh, Jor, it's so hard. How do we meditate? That's what we've been doing every day at 3:35 since the COVID happened, since we were on lockdown. You have been meditating. I know I like to call it breathing because it's sneaky, but it's meditating. So here's what we're going to do, folks, in order to increase our empathy for folks that have been so horrifically affected, like Bubba Wallace, who had a noose in his garage. We'll talk about that in NASCAR a little bit later. For all of the family of George Floyd, for anybody struggling and suffering right now, we are meditating to create more empathy. Just, I want you to just put your hands over your heart. Put both of your hands on your heart. Sit comfortably. And I just want you to breathe with me three times. Ready? And out. Try to clear your mind. Breathe in. Breathe out. Feel your heart and your breath and breathe in. And breathe out one more time. Keep doing this, and you are officially meditating. You are officially cultivating empathy and kindness. You need that, and the world needs that. Keep going.
Sure, in the early morning hours of Friday, May 29th, the Dunord Warehouse building in Minneapolis, home to America's first black-owned micro distillery, was set on fire. It was looted. The damage was incomprehensible, and yet the owners have found a way to keep going, and they've reinvented themselves over the past few weeks, which have been traumatic. Chanel Montana co-owns Dunord Craft Spirits with her amazing husband, Chris, and Chanel joins us today on CCO. Hey, Chanel.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
How are you doing? You have had just an unbelievable few weeks. So how are you holding up with your husband?
It's been an unbelievable year, that's for sure. But no, we are doing very well. And if there's anything that I want to leave your listeners with, it's that there is so much hope out there right now. So we're doing well.
It's great to hear you talk about hope, because not one, but several fires were set inside of your Minneapolis distillery warehouse. Can you tell us the story of how this evolved?
Yes, absolutely. So we obviously, after the murder of George Floyd, it was something that was in our neighborhood, something that affected us personally and professionally, and we wanted to be a part of the peaceful protests that were taking place, and we were handing out sanitizer and water at the peaceful protests. And as we noticed what was happening sort of, you know, into the evening and then later in the night, we did have our staff go home early, and we started to take the precautions in case things did go in a more negative way, as they definitely did. That evening, you know, the first night, we had realized we had come out just fine. And what we had said is, as these things escalate, we're putting our business in the hands of the community, because at the end of the day, it's tough, and there's just not much we can do about the riots if they're taking place. And we did that, and our amazing staff ended up coming back to the facility and putting signs up indicating that the cocktail room and that our business was Black-owned. And then in addition to that, they just were there for us. They were there for us personally. Our staff were just wonderful. But we did have damage the third night of the riots, and we got word of that very early in the morning just because there were security cameras around. We waited until sun up, partially because my husband is Black, and, you know, he was very nervous about being in that area with not only law enforcement presence, but presence of the riots and looting. But we just felt it wasn't safe to be there right away, even though we knew what was going on. So in the light of day, we did go back, and we were able to extinguish some of the fires that were set. We were very fortunate that our sprinkler system did exactly what it was meant to be, and we actually have much more damage from the sprinklers than we do from the actual fires. Yeah, it was a very fascinating turn of events, and in the end, we actually came out just fine.
Well, and Chanel, I'm genuinely in awe of how you were able to pivot and create this food bank to help the local community. And a couple of questions come to mind. A, are you going to rebuild? Are you still going to be in the micro distillery business? And tell listeners about the Dunord Riot Recovery Fund. You've raised, what, well over $500,000?
Yes, it's been amazing. So we realized very quickly, once we got our building cleaned out, the fire is extinguished. There was about a foot of water in there that needed to get removed from the premise. And so we were able to do that and start to dry out. And we realized very quickly that the majority of South Minneapolis at that point was a food desert. And we have a number of families that live near the Lake Street area because it is a transit corridor, because there is public transportation and there is shopping and food and everything. With all of that gone, there's a huge need for families everywhere. And so we did quickly transition actually that Saturday to being a food bank. And we put a call out to our social media contacts and to our friends to help us basically establish this. And before we knew it, we had truckloads of diapers and canned foods and mac and cheese and cereal all coming our way, and an amazing team of volunteers behind us, making sure that the families that lived in that area could still provide for themselves.
Wow.
Tell me about that headspace. You have all this damage. You have fire, you have water damage. I imagine you're also thinking about your business. You're already hit hard from COVID. And for those who don't know, obviously you make Dunord vodka, but you switched to making hand sanitizer after the COVID-19 orders shut down your tasting room. So you already had to pivot. And now, I mean, where's the space to think about, oh, my insurance claim and this? You don't do that. You start collecting diapers. What kind of mindset is that? Because you are, you guys are incredible. I'm in awe of you.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I appreciate that. You know, I will say that throughout this entire thing, Dunord, for anyone who knows us, I mean, we put blood, sweat, and tears into Dunord, and it is,
yes,
a very emotional thing for us. But I think both my husband and I got to a place where, in him much, much earlier than I, where we realized this is just stuff, and it's stuff that we can rebuild and maybe we can do better. And we had to take the long view of say, if this is what's going to create change, if this is what's going to make people who don't normally think about race start thinking about it and talking about it and being okay tackling some of these issues, then bring it on. You know, it's just stuff. And we had to take that view of this could really be a big change for South Minneapolis, a big change for America. And if our stuff is the casualty, that's fine. We can rebuild. So that was really where we had to go. And I'll tell you, as a white woman, it took me a little bit longer than my husband, who could see the forest through the trees much faster. But it changed how we approached all of it. And once we realized the potential for it, we realized how much positive could come. As far as the food bank, I mean, we could see the need, and we knew it had to happen. And people wanted to help; they wanted to have a way to contribute. And so we were able to not only provide that, but we were feeding 400 families a day at some point. So it was something that was just needed. We had to.
And again, we have to take a break, Chanel, but you've been so amazing. And something your husband, Chris, said, he said, if it means, you know, our loss, if it means we don't have to have the conversation with our kids and tell them about how things would be different for them because of the color of their skin, you do it over again. And that just really struck me, the sacrifices that you've already made. So best of luck and our best wishes and... can't wait to see
Chanel,
how you progress. Oh, I'm sorry.
Before we let you go, what else do you need, and can we help? Are you still collecting food? How can the listeners and Paul and I and David help?
So we have moved to Holy Trinity Church. They are collecting food. There'll be more information online from them. In addition, go to the Dunord Riot Recovery Fund. We have not met our $1 million goal yet, and we would love to. That money will be going to predominantly Black and Brown businesses in the Lake Street area so they can recover and get back to where they were.
Dunord, is it Family Recovery Fund?
Dunord Riot Recovery Fund. It's a GoFundMe that was set up.
Beautiful.
And so
beautiful.
There's more information on our Facebook page, the Dunord Facebook page, and it's the Dunord Riot Recovery Fund.
You guys are fabulous. Thank you so, so much. Thank you for everything you're doing, and thank you for the time, Chanel. We really appreciate you.
Thank you, Chanel.
Thank
we
you
wish
so
you
much.
The very best. You bet. Hang in
yep.
there.
And everybody, go drink Dunord Craft Spirits when they're back. Find them, patronize them, get the hand sanitizer, do whatever you can to help out these folks. They are amazing.
These are such strange times for so many of us. When we come back, I want you to hear something that a friend of mine, an entrepreneur that I admire, Tom Kiefer, had to say. This is the time to pivot to what's next. How do you do that? Stick around. You should stay. But please stay at least 6 feet away from me and put the mask on. If nothing else, as a sign of respect, a sign of humanity, a sign of kindness. Paul and Jordana, DJ producing today, Dave Josephson. Yesterday had an interesting chat with Tom Kiefer, a serial entrepreneur, talking about this uniquely momentous time in history between the pandemic and the unrest and the general malaise. This may be a good time to consider a career switch. Here's what Tom had to say.
Right. Well, I think first thing people need to appreciate is the fact that in times of great change are times of great opportunity. And of course, as an entrepreneur, I see the world that way. You're the same way. And so I think everybody needs to sort of see the world more that way now and take a little more self-agency, create your next opportunity. Don't expect that you're going to be able to go back to the same job that you had. And if you do go back to the same employer, chances are the complexion of that job is going to change. I think a couple of the big trends and places I would look would be, first of all, you know, this whole COVID-19 and even Black Lives Matter has really caused a big reset in people's thinking. I think everyone's going back to slowing down a little bit, friends and family, you know, kind of getting off that hamster wheel, so to speak, and really focusing on what matters. So that means that essentials and, you know, pragmatic, practical things. So when you're starting to look at a job or tweaking your skills or learning new skills, I think that essentials are going to continue to be huge opportunities for people. I mean, even to look at the lockdown, the essential industries, you know, were deemed such by our bureaucrats and generally true. And those people kept working and haven't seen much interruption. So I'd say relative to that, maybe look out and see what kind of certifications are available in your industry. You may not be able to afford the time or economics of actually going back to school. You know, as you know, I'm on the board of trustees over at Dunwoody, right, a great trade school. But in IT, HR, accounting, there's a lot of industries where you can go back and get certifications and really sort of quickly evidence to your employer that you're ready for the next thing. Another thing I do is I encourage people to look at their jobs, look at their companies and say, okay, what new technologies, what trends are happening? And as opposed to having it happen to you, you know, embrace it and help it happen. So automation, efficiency, you know, how do you lower costs? I mean, many of my business friends, who of course we're talking to each other all the time because there's not much else to do, a lot of conversations, most of them are not assuming that they're going to have as many employees when all this is over. They're going to be able to get by with less. So I think employees need to understand that. And like I said earlier, you know, there ain't no status quo. You know, we're going back to something new. So make it your own. Don't just let it happen to you. Right. Make it your own. And then the last thing I'd say, and I think all this has become more evident to us here through these recent crises, is find a way to get closer to the customer. You know, within your company, within your business, are there some things, are there roles, are there things you can do within your job that will get you closer to the customer, help in that regard? And if that's of interest to you, make it known, because those are critical roles. And almost every company I know is always looking for people who are genuinely interested in engaging with and helping customers.
That was Tom Kiefer yesterday on the Sunday morning show, Jor. And for years, he's been telling me, reminding me, you know, it's easy to get fixated on the competition when you should be fixated on your customers and asking customers what they want that they don't have. I mean, a classic example is Amazon. I mean, truly customer-centric. How do we exceed customer expectations? But, you know, I'm seeing some estimates, 40% of the jobs lost may not come back. And when you think about it, any job that requires, that can be automated, is going to be automated. Mm-hmm. Because robots don't get sick. Robots don't ask for raises. So the onus is on us to take those calculated risks, get out of our comfort zone, network, connect the dots, gig economy. you know, maybe 2, 3, 4 gigs each, paying a little bit every month. But that way, if something goes south, you're not totally out of luck.
And make no mistake, this is an opportunity for companies to lean up, to cut fat, to do more with less, and not go back to the way it was. This is a cost-cutting method. It's up to us to not get too in the weeds and become right. The cost-cutties. When we get back, Beyonce's new song. You're going to love it. Next on News Talk A3O WCCO.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of 4 amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get 4 iPhone 15s on us and 4 lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.